Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We are your hosts, Matt Levine.
And Vincent Hannum.
And we're talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between, all strange beasts are welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. Thank you all for hanging out, friends. Please rate and review wherever you listen to Camp Kaiju. You can also share this podcast with a friend. We would be eternally grateful for that. And please do send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com. What's going on our website these days?
It's still the hot spot for past episodes of Camp Kaiju, as well as news that we got going on. And you can read blogged reviews Matt and I are typing up about other monster movies we don't have a chance to feature on the show. For instance, I just posted a review about the 1935 film Mad Love with Peter Lorre and some killer hands, and comparing and contrasting it to the very new release Tearsucker, which we featured recently on the show. So I don't know, just kind of fun stuff like that, where you get maybe a deeper dive into film history and analysis. Yeah.
And it's an awesome review. I read it and I loved it, and I definitely recommend that people check it out. I feel like we should also take a moment to plug your own work, because you have a dismembered hand-themed play coming up in the Twin Cities, right?
Right. So me watching Mad Love was not purely accidental. Yeah, the killer hand genre. It's a weird subgenre of horror films, of monster films, I would say. And I wrote my own one act concerning a disembodied hand that wreaks havoc on a team of construction workers in Minnesota. The play is called The Hand That Washed Ashore, and it will be featured in the Twin Cities Horror Festival of Plays this October. Just reach out if you are curious about what that is. And if you want to talk killer hand movies, I'm always here for that. There's some good ones out there and some bad ones that I'd love to talk about.
One of the bad ones for me is the movie The Hand, directed by Oliver Stone, weirdly enough, starring Michael Caine. It is a terrible, terrible movie, but I hope to talk to somebody about that movie someday, because it's like interestingly bad, you know? So yeah. Two thumbs down, or maybe one thumb down from a dismembered hand is what I would give that movie.
Or one big middle finger up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So don't watch that one, but I'm very excited for your play. October, that's coming up. I'm intrigued to hear more about it.
Yeah. Well, why don't you go ahead and plug what you got creatively? You just started a new Substack.
Yes. So my partner Kelly actually told me about Substack. So shout out to Kelly. I've been talking to her about how, like, I don't want to criticize any web platforms out there. I had been using a different service, which I didn't like very much. It was like very difficult to update it and like format the homepage and stuff like that. So Kelly was like, oh, try out Substack. Like, it's designed to be easy for writers to like post new content. And it's like kind of automatically sending out emails to subscribers and very easy to share on social media and stuff like that. And it's been great so far. I kind of just launched this new Substack. It's MatthewColeLevine.substack.com. It's a lot of movie reviews on there, but also some fiction excerpts and hopefully some publishing updates as well. So I'm pretty excited to write some more on there.
Yeah, it's cool stuff.
Thank you. Hopefully more monster movie reviews on there and on CampKaijuMovieReviews.com in the near future as well.
Yeah, look at us. We have subscribed to both of our respective film review websites.
Yeah, we're plugging everything. Let's plug away. Speaking of which,
No, I just wanted to actually give a quick shout out to our supporters on Patreon, because while we don't actively promote the Patreon anymore, it is still there and we still have supporters who are very generous and very kind and willing to support our podcast. So Jason, our anonymous donor, you know who you are. Kelly and Peggy, thank you for your support. We should have thanked you with the Godzilla Raids Again episode, but hopefully you still know that you are loved and support and honored by us.
Indeed. We're very grateful for your support. Yeah, and we're just excited to have a community of people to talk to monster movies about. So, you know, send us your comments and your emails, and you know, hopefully we'll feature your feedback on an upcoming episode.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, what do we have coming up on our soon-to-be-released episodes, Vincent?
Well, we are going... So, tonight we're talking about King Kong. Next week, we're going back to Godzilla in the 21st century. We're going to talk about Godzilla, Mothra, and King Ghidorah, giant monsters, all-out attack from the millennium era of Godzilla films. So, with a title like that, where can you go wrong? I have a lot of thoughts, actually, about where you might go wrong, but I will save it for next week.
Yeah, we might have similar thoughts, but we'll find out soon.
We may not be in the majority of opinion with those thoughts. I don't know.
Yeah, I've gotten that impression, but we'll find out soon. So make sure you check out that episode. That does seem like a weirdly divisive movie, so there'll be a lot to talk about there.
Yeah. And then after that, in August, we're definitely going to talk about Starship Troopers. But then, Matt, you were thinking about another movie maybe to squeeze in there?
Yeah. So one of our friends, Jason, I think, mentioned this when we saw King Kong. But he recommended Tremors as kind of like a 1990s, although I think Tremors maybe is 89, but it's certainly like around that same time period. Maybe it's 90.
It was released in 90, but it might have been filmed in 89.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, hopefully Tremors. I think that would be great. I love Tremors, and I've been wanting to talk about that on the show for a while. So
same. One of my, yeah. I mean, like, forget about monster movies. Tremors is actually one of my, if it's not my top 10, it's in my top 15 favorite movies of all time.
I love that. And it's like so synonymous with my youth, you know? Yeah. I watched that all the time as a kid.
Right. Yeah, we'll talk about it later.
Yeah, yeah. So probably Tremors, that's still maybe to be confirmed, but yeah, Starship Troopers for sure is coming up in August.
Yeah.
Which will be great.
It's an exciting month.
Yeah, totally, yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like Vincent said, we're talking about the original King Kong tonight, and the sort of motivation or catalyst for us talking about this is that the movie just played on a beautiful 35mm film print at the Heights Theater in Minneapolis. Thanks to the Heights, they're, you know, an incredible theater. They show a lot of stuff on film whenever they can. Really, really happy that we were able to see this movie on the big screen.
Yeah, and I think, well, yeah, I mean, and it was such a great experience seeing it live with other people, and especially seeing it with, again, some of our supporters of Camp Kaiju in the Twin Cities, and getting to talk about the movie before and after, but sitting in on an audience watching a movie that's celebrating its 90th anniversary this year is such, there's no experience like it. And like, it was similar to when we watched Frankenstein last year at the Trilon. Mm-hmm. Suddenly the movie is funny. Suddenly the movie is scarier than it ever is just watching it by yourself at home. I was like, there's some unintentional humor in King Kong, I think, that comes with 90 years, but there were still some lines that were just delivered perfectly with their comedic timing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like the gasps that you would hear in the audience at like the more intense or like brutal or scary moments, you know, like they definitely do seem more visceral and more impactful when you're like with an audience watching it in that way. So it was a special experience for sure.
Yeah, there were some kids in the audience, some young kids who I think were among those gasping. Yeah, which is really exciting to hear.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
the infamously brutal T-Rex fight, I think, had a lot of reactions too. So we'll be talking about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, King Kong is an all-time classic. You've seen this before, right? Before our most recent viewing.
Yeah, this is one of those movies that I can't even tell you the first time I saw it. It was just, if I don't remember seeing it, I just like grew up knowing about it because it's such a part of our cultural DNA, yeah. Especially with the movies. If you watch any like those AFI Oscar highlight reels of movie clips, King Kong is always in those clips.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and like when you see those scenes, like the Empire State Building scene or like the first appearance of King Kong, you know, like it's you know, those moments are probably very familiar, like you said, to anybody that likes movies. But when you see them in the context of the film, they just hit so much harder, you know? It's yeah, they're classic for a reason. So,
yeah. I did buy the DVD in 2005. Randomly, because like I wasn't into monster movies when I was a teenager. I was more into like just straight up dramas and, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. But I bought the DVD and then I rewatched it. I revisited it a few years ago. So in my adult life, I've had to come back to this movie with a lot of appreciation. But it was always there in the cultural mind.
Right. Yeah. Like few other movies are, I think, you know, everybody knows King Kong.
I've seen King Kong numerous times by now, sort of like you. I also forget like when was the first time that happened. I feel like I was very young and it was probably on TV, 5 or 6, maybe. I watched it several times in high school. So this was maybe like the 10th time or something that I saw it, but I had never seen it on the big screen before. Yeah. With, you know, like you said, like a packed house or whatever. And it's a totally different experience. And I think also like when you watch it and you're young, you're just like, oh, it's a big ape. Cool. But mm-hmm. like when you get older, you realize like all the context of the movie and like what was going on in Hollywood and just in like the United States at the time. And it takes on a little bit more complexity in like both good and bad ways, you know?
Yeah. Huge amount of social context with the film's release. And context with 90 years since its release, like where our society has gone in attitudes about all sorts of things since 1933.
You know, it is hard to watch some of these scenes in King Kong without like modern awareness, you know, and, you know, I'm definitely a believer that like you need to place historical things in their context and maybe not like condone them, but certainly understand like what was going on at the time. But like, it's very, very hard to do that with some scenes in King Kong. So I'm sure we'll talk about that soon.
Yeah, I'd love to get into all that.
All right. The story's probably pretty familiar to a lot of people, but should we jump into the plot of King Kong?
Sure. All right. So we have filmmaker Carl Denham. He's known for making spectacular adventure movies in jungles and other exotic settings. And he's about to set sail from New York on a chartered ship called The Venture. He's been told that he needs to have a romantic subplot in his next film. So he finds a young woman named Anne Darrow on the streets of New York and promises her the adventure of a lifetime. I should also add that this is set in 1933 at the height of the Depression. So Anne Darrow, as an out-of-work actress, or is she an actor in this movie? I can't remember. Either way, she needs some money and she's game. So the next morning, the Venture sets sail, after which Denham informs the crew that they're headed for the mysterious Skull Island, an uncharted territory on which a beast named Kong supposedly dwells.
After landing on the island, the crew encounters a native village, where a group of natives are preparing to sacrifice a young woman to be the bride of Kong. After spotting Anne among the intruders, the natives offer to trade 6 of their own women for Anne, but the crew refuses and heads back to the ship. That night, the natives steal onto the Venture and kidnap Anne, taking her back to the island, where she is brought through a massive gate and tied to an altar as an offering to Kong, who turns out to be a massive ape.
Denham and the crew of the Venture race into the jungle after Anne, who has been taken away by Kong. On the island, they find a number of fantastic creatures, including dinosaurs and massive aquatic beasts. The ship's first mate, Driscoll, who has fallen in love with Anne, eventually tracks her down and rescues her as Kong is busy fighting a pteranodon. Kong chases them back to the gate near where their ship is anchored, where the gorilla is subdued by Denham's gas bombs and brought back to the United States as a marvelous attraction, dubbed the Eighth Wonder of the World. In New York, however, tragedy strikes atop the Empire State Building, where beauty kills the beast. It is, I mean, the ending is legendary, and you forget. When I came back to this movie as an adult, I didn't realize how much action and adventure existed in this movie beyond the final third in New York. Yeah. Skull Island is a nightmare world of all sorts of giant monsters, and it's awesome.
It is, yeah. From the moment that Kong appears, it's kind of like nonstop action for the rest of the movie, like probably about an hour or so, maybe a little bit more. Watching it this last time, I was like, you know, being on Skull Island is probably what like living in Australia is like. Every time you turn around, there's like a huge spider, or like a snake, or like a shark, or like something waiting to kill you. It's probably the exact same thing, you know?
Yeah.
I've never been to Australia, but that's the impression that I get. I can only imagine it's the same thing.
Well, I'm from Florida, and it's basically the Australia of America.
That seems like an insult to Australia, but okay. But yeah, I mean, like you said, there are so many classic moments in this movie, again, that just like, you know, when you watch them in the context of the film, they're even more magical. And that ending is one of the best examples.
Mm-hmm.
So jumping into the crew of the film a little bit, King Kong was co-directed by Ernest B. Schoedsack and Marion C. Cooper, both of whom have just very interesting life stories. I feel like a biography could be made about either of these guys. That would be very, very fascinating. Cooper grew up kind of wanting to be an explorer. He was an accomplished fighter pilot during World War I and also during the Polish-Soviet War, which he joined voluntarily. After he returned to the United States after those wars, he became a journalist. He wrote for the New York Times. He had a lifelong interest in aviation. And like I said, he always wanted to be an explorer. He was in love with foreign cultures in, again, some good and bad ways, in a sort of like colonialist, condescending way, which we'll talk about soon. But yeah, just a really interesting life story. Schoedsack, meanwhile, ran away from home at 14 years old, and he started off as a cameraman for Mack Sennett, the silent comedian, in 1914. Schoedsack served as a cameraman and a fighter pilot during World War I, and he also served in the Signal Corps. After the war, he served in the American Red Cross and helped refugees escape from the Polish-Soviet War. So already there's kind of a lot of overlap between the two men. However, Cooper and Schoedsack wouldn't actually meet until the early 1920s. They traveled by sea to Ethiopia and met the Emperor Haile Selassie. It was kind of like a, you know, geographical expedition funded by some American government organization. I can't remember which one. So like their sort of like desire to be explorers and see the world was already fully, you know, fully formed at that time. The first film that they worked on together was called Grass, A Nation's Battle for Life in 1925. It was a pseudo-documentary, presented as a documentary, but many scenes were actually staged for the camera, that was shot in Iran that followed that country's Bakhtiari people. When Grass came out, it caught the attention of producer Jesse Lasky, who commissioned Schoedsack and Cooper to make the 1927 film Chang, which is a silent documentary about a farmer in northern Thailand. Once again, this is a documentary, kind of a name only. There's a lot of fictional elements and a lot of things that are staged for the camera that Schoedsack and Cooper set up. So just to kind of continue their backstory a little bit, Schoedsack and Cooper also produced the 1929 film The Four Feathers, which was actually shot in the Sudan. It was not shot in the United States or on a studio. So like all these films were actually shot in authentic exotic locales. In fact, Cooper's biographer, Mark Cotta Vaz, emphasizes their criteria of distant, difficult, and dangerous stories from an unequivocally Western, unmistakably white ideological perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think all this is a really fascinating backstory for King Kong, because even though King Kong is this, you know, fantastical, magical story, we see a lot of this maybe not pseudo-documentary, but like presented as like a window into another world, like an exotic locale and another culture that was, you know, very popular to American audiences at the time.
Yeah. So just to, I'm going to expand upon that, and then I'm going to bring it back down to these individuals themselves. So where was the world really at this time? Still completely under European colonization. Many of the Asian countries and African countries were under this system, and jungle stories of adventure were very popular going back decades into the 1800s. I don't know. I think of Heart of Darkness, for example. The Tarzan stories were in the early 20th century. A inspiration for Cooper that's often cited is an 1860s account called Explorations and Adventures in Equatorial Africa by a French explorer, which, I don't know, by everything I've read is just a very, just a an account, an observational sort of journal of this man's adventures in Africa. But there is a there's an illustration of a gorilla in that, which Cooper cites and other people cite as sort of what lodged into Cooper's imagination. Speaking of gorillas, they were new to Western populations at this time. It was not easy to capture a gorilla before the age of tranquilizers and ship it to a zoo in Europe or North America. At this time, some zoos started to acquire gorillas and the public were fascinated by them. So I found that interesting, thinking about why King Kong as a gorilla exists, why that sort of captured the popular imagination. I also wanted to say, so about the movie Chang, the natural drama that Cooper and Shostak made, I've seen clips of Chang, and there are images in that film that mirror images in King Kong, like the native village, like the house that's on the raised up high on the pillars. That is from Chang. So you could see those elements of like, yeah, let's just keep using what was working.
Totally. Yeah. And I like with Chang too, there were some scenes that endangered the cast and crew, like scenes of actual wildlife, like an elephant stampeding and like destroying houses. Another scene where a tiger kind of rushes the camera, which is literally what happened during the making of the movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of overlap for sure between Chang and King Kong, but King Kong kind of like, you know, it's safely stowed away and it maybe not so safely stowed away. And it's like, you know, fantasy magical land. Whereas Chang, they were putting their lives at risk, you know?
Right. And I'm not going to say we all know, but it's no secret that the character of Carl Denham is modeled after Marion C. Cooper, this outgoing adventurer, maverick filmmaker. And there's a line in King Kong where Carl Denham is like, I don't use cameramen because a rhino charged us once and the cameraman dropped the camera. And like that might as well be Marion C. Cooper speaking about his experiences filming wildlife.
I feel like there's a, like, it's kind of self-congratulatory, but also like self-mocking a little bit, you know, like what Denham does in this movie is not, it has a very tragic, disastrous end. So if it is about Cooper, there's a, like a touch of like, self-deprecation in there, I think, you know?
Yeah.
I also read that the character of Driscoll is largely based on Shostak, which like maybe does not reflect well on Shostak, but who knows like where reality ends and fiction begins, you know?
Right. Well, Ruth Rose, one of the credited screenwriters, was married to Shostak. And not only was she his wife and co-screenwriter, but she accompanied Cooper and Shostak to all of their locations overseas, doing all of the business required. in support of their making the film. So she was right there with them. And she says, well, she modeled denim on Cooper. She took inspiration. And she and Shostak fell in love, apparently on a ship, the way Jack and Anne do.
To the Galapagos Islands, I think, which is a pretty, like, I don't know, it's a very romantic backstory, you know? Who knows what actually happened, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, these are the things that I just, like, you know, when you watch King Kong as a kid, you don't realize all this stuff, you don't think about it, but, like, watching it now and, like, realizing how much self-reflexivity there is in the movie, it's just pretty fascinating. And we'll talk about all these themes and other things that come into play, but, yeah, there's a lot to it.
Sorry. I was just going to say, I don't know if you have this in your notes because I'm not looking at the notes right now, but so Cooper, he always had this image of wanting to make some sort of gorilla movie, a giant gorilla movie. And he had different images throughout the years. Like, he thought, you know, what if a gorilla climbed to the top of the tallest building in New York and fought airplanes? But he was also inspired by the, I don't know if it was a recent discovery, but again, the recent cultural awareness, Western awareness of another creature called the Komodo dragon, which is like as long as a crocodile, but it's like a giant lizard, very deadly. They are man eaters. Don't mess with these things. But they, at one point, Cooper wanted to make a movie where he would capture a live gorilla in Africa and take it to Komodo Island, which is in Indonesia, and make a movie using miniatures of the gorilla battling the Komodo dragon.
Wow.
And everyone said, no, what are you, crazy?
Terrible idea. Yeah. Why would you do that? It's probably for the best that did not work out.
For us and the animal world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, some of those things, some of those, like, kind of childlike fancies or whatever, whimsy, I guess, like, does make its way into King Kong for sure, but, like, not in, like, a literal way, so that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, we still get a gorilla reptile fight, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, obviously it's, you know, it's models instead of real animals, but it's still, you know, as we'll talk about, it's like very intense, really well done, and very transportive is the word that I would use.
That's a good word.
Well, thank you.
Do you write movie reviews?
Sometimes, not often enough though. Getting into the crew of the film a little bit more, one of the most famous crew members in this case is Willis O'Brien, who did the special effects for the film. Really revolutionary special effects. So O'Brien and King Kong are kind of seen as stop motion pioneers. This is sort of like when the art form came together a little bit. Although O'Brien also did the special effects for The Lost World in 1925, based on an Arthur Conan Doyle story. The Last Days of Pompeii in 1935, O'Brien did the special effects for that as well. And Mighty Joe Young in 1949, which sort of serves as a reunion for a lot of people that worked on King Kong. Fay Wray is in that movie. Shostak and Cooper directed that. I think also Ruth Rose, she wrote that film as well. So it's kind of a reunion of sorts. But anyway, O'Brien's life story also is very fascinating. Actually, you're a big Willis O'Brien fan, aren't you?
I mean, yeah, who isn't, right? I love Ray Harryhausen. I've seen more of his movies, but Harryhausen literally apprenticed under O'Brien. I'll get to more of that in a little bit. But yeah, I'd love to talk about O'Brien for a little bit. As like if there's a trifecta of King Kong's creators, you have Cooper, Shostak, and O'Brien. O'Brien's life, also just as interesting. He had a lot of different jobs. He was an aspiring sculptor, illustrator. He was a boxer, which you can see, I think, hints of that when Kong is duking it out with the T-Rex. O'Brien was an architectural draftsman. He was a railroad surveyor. So kind of did a lot. But it was his model work that caught the attention of San Francisco exhibitor Herman Wober, who commissioned O'Brien to make a 1915 film called The Dinosaur and the Missing Link. This was also financed by Thomas Edison, I came across. And I'm getting a lot of my information from that two-disc DVD I bought back in 05. There's a four-hour documentary about the whole making of King Kong.
Wow.
Yeah, I just spent my whole afternoon just watching it.
I need to see that. I tried to do research without even watching that. So my life would have been a lot easier if I had.
Yeah, well, this is why physical media is great.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I think it's cool, too. Well, just say, you know, O'Brien, I read that he, you know, he you mentioned like all the different jobs that he had when he was young. He competed in rodeos and he also developed an interest in dinosaurs when he was working as a guide for paleontologists in the Crater Lake region. So I think it's kind of cool, like these origin stories where we see his love for dinosaurs had kind of maybe like an origin in his personal life. You know, I love stories like that.
Yeah. And just like the jungle and jungle animals, dinosaurs were also entering the public consciousness in the early 20th century. I mean, they were only discovered, well, quote unquote discovered, in the 1800s, when scientists first went, these are an extinct animal's bones. So I think, yeah, I think King Kong is a great amalgamation of all of these like natural wonders that were on people's minds. But the dinosaur and the missing link, I saw some footage of that. It looks really fun and funny. It's total stop motion, but this is when O'Brien started fiddling with stop motion. There may have been some other people working on it, like in France, but according to Harryhausen on these documentaries I was watching, it was like O'Brien's gift to filmmaking that he started on in the 19 teens. Like you mentioned, The Lost World, some other movies in the 20s, and then 33 was this culmination.
Yeah, so he'd been working on stop motion animation for almost 20 years at that point. So it kind of makes sense that, you know, he knew what he was doing. He had been trying all these different tricks and effects for a long time. And yeah, he kind of perfected them with King Kong.
Have you seen The Lost World?
I have, not for a long time, though. It's cool. Like, the effects are pretty interesting, but it doesn't have the, like, magic that King Kong does, you know?
Right, that's what I was going to say. Like, the stop motion dinosaurs are effective. And yet, there's a crudeness to them that is not there in King Kong. Like in King Kong, the creatures are crisp, they're clean. They look less like fudge. That's not the right word. Play-Doh.
Yeah.
In early, like these early silent stop motion films, I don't know. I felt like the dinosaurs sort of had an unrefined Play-Doh quality.
Yeah.
But he was learning.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, you know, again, it makes sense that all of it would kind of be perfected in this like huge Hollywood endeavor.
Yeah.
Which is King Kong. On a similar note, kind of going more into the crew a little bit and changing topics slightly, the film was executive produced by David O. Selznick, who started working at RKO in 1931. Selznick is like one of the most famous producers of all time in Hollywood history. He was basically was the producer that brought Alfred Hitchcock to the United States. He produced Gone with the Wind, to use one like very famous example. So Selznick left Paramount for RKO in 1931. He was only at RKO for 15 months, so barely more than a year. But in that time, he produced some amazing films like King Kong, and he also pioneered the unit production system in Hollywood, where like a single producer would be in charge of like a genre or a certain type of film, and that would allow the producers and the directors to have a lot more creative freedom. Whereas before that, it kind of was more of like a central producer system where one producer would be in charge of everything and would dictate very specifically to directors like what they could and couldn't do. So it's not really an exaggeration to say that Selznick made it possible for artists and auteurs to work in Hollywood. And King Kong was one of his first projects for RKO. He greenlit the project. He brought Marion C. Cooper on board. And yeah, he tried to downplay his involvement with the film for the most part. He said that this was, you know, Cooper and Schoedsack and O'Brien's creation, but it wouldn't have been possible in the first place without his support. So pretty fascinating backstory there too.
Yeah, in all of my movie buff life, David O. Selznick is a name that always comes up. I have never once heard it come up with King Kong.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was very young. I mean, he started, I think, in the late silent period. So he was, you know, a relatively young, but still kind of superstar producer, you know? And I, you know, I feel like producers kind of have like a bad guy label in Hollywood where they're just like the brain dead money men who like don't know what the hell they're doing, basically. But like, at least in some cases, they made great works of art possible. And, you know, I think Selznick was kind of like a tyrannical figure, like very much like, you know, what I say goes and stuff like that. But that's what kind of makes him so interesting, in my opinion.
Yeah. Since we're on the topic of Selznick, forgive me for jumping around a little bit, but do you have things about the would-be film creation in your notes?
A little bit, yeah. That's coming up in a little bit here.
Okay. I'll wait.
I know we're kind of all over the place because there are so many tangents that we can bring into a King Kong discussion.
Yeah.
We could talk about this movie for the next 8 hours, but we'll try to be a little bit more concise about it.
All right. I'll wait.
Okay. And I don't know a lot about creation, but it is in here. So when we get to it, maybe I'll let you take it away from there.
Okay.
Let's see. The screenplay is by James Ashmore Creelman, who also wrote The Most Dangerous Game. We'll be talking about that movie a little bit more also. He co-wrote The Last Days of Pompeii as well. And we already talked about Ruth Rose, Schoedsack's wife, who co-wrote the script of King Kong. Later, she would write or co-write the script for Son of Kong, which came out the same year in 1933. It was a sequel that was rushed into production. She also wrote the screenplays for She, The Last Days of Pompeii, along with Creelman, and Mighty Joe Young. So a lot of, you know, kind of overlap here among this crew. The last crew member who I think we should talk about is Max Steiner, who did the soundtrack for King Kong, a revolutionary, groundbreaking soundtrack. Some would say the first soundtrack for an American talkie in film history. How familiar are you with Steiner, Vincent?
I would just want to also shout out the sound designer, Murray Spivak, who worked closely with Steiner, obviously in coordinating the music with the sound effects, which were also very new because, lest we forget, 1933 was still very early for talking movies and for not just speech, but synchronized sound effects.
Yeah.
So a lot of sound effects had to be created for this movie because RKO, there was no files, no database to go back and pull sound effects. Like, things had to be created then and there for everything, especially related to the creatures involved with the movie.
I read that like for this film, there were three different literal soundtracks that were created, one only for the sound effects, one for the dialogue, and one for the music that could then be like manipulated individually to kind of like, you know, make sure one didn't like drown out the other and make sure they kind of corresponded very well. So really, in sound and music in general, this was a revolutionary production. Just to go back to Max Steiner real quick.
Yeah.
You know, he's referred to by some as the father of film music. He created the score for films like Gone with the Wind, Casablanca, The Searchers, many more. I know, like, that sounds like so hyperbolic to say, like, the man who created film soundtracks. But if it was anybody, it might have been Steiner.
But that's what we're saying about this movie. It's the father of film scores. It's the father of sound design with Spivak. It's O'Brien, who is the father of stop motion, but also just visual effects, which go beyond the stop motion in this movie. Yeah.
Yeah, revolutionary.
It can't be understated how important this movie was to developing film techniques.
Right. Yeah, classic for a reason, for sure. Yeah. And, you know, Steiner would even kind of develop certain musical motifs for certain characters, like King Kong, of course, but also for Ann Darrow. And then towards the end, when there's, like, you know, all these kind of melancholy looks shared between them. The themes kind of go back and forth a little bit in the music. So, yeah, a lot of things going on in the music to this film. And, you know, Marion C. Cooper said that the music was responsible for 25% of the film's power. I don't know how accurate that is, but yeah, I mean, I think that's a good estimate, you know?
What I did come across in my Steiner research was because RKO just wanted to use stock music for this film. The budget was already ballooning, and it was either Cooper or Shostak told Steiner, "Don't worry about it." And they told RKO, or Steiner did, "Look, the music we have in stock does not fit the story we're telling. It has to be as tailored as this score by Steiner." RKO was initially wary of the score. There's a film term called Mickey Mousing, I'm using air quotes, where apparently that's when the music, think of a cartoon, like a Looney Tune, the music is synchronized to an action on the screen. So there are some examples in King Kong where the chief of the natives, he's stepping down the stairs, and with each step, the score matches it with a bump, 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 bump. Or when Kong is like tickling and Darrow, there's a little flourish in the score.
Yeah.
That's called Mickey Mousing, apparently.
Huh.
Critics liked it, and RKO was like, okay, no, it's a brilliant score. Keep it.
Hindsight's always 20/20, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, those things are probably kind of like second nature to us now as film viewers and listeners. Like, you know, I mean, that's been done so often by composers since then that it's kind of like just how film scores are done. But at the time, it was, yeah, to your point, kind of a radical change, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So a very impressive crew for this movie. Also, of course, an extremely impressive cast. First and foremost, we have to talk about Fay Wray as Ann Darrow. She was one of the original scream queens of cinema. She starred in horror movies like Dr. X, The Mystery of the Wax Museum, and The Most Dangerous Game, which was shot on the same set at the same time as King Kong. They shot King Kong during the day on this set and The Most Dangerous Game at night. And both Fay Wray and Robert Armstrong, we'll talk about in a second here, were in both movies. So RKO was trying to make the most of their money, you know?
And one more progenitor, Fay Wray, the mother of the Scream Queens. The, you know what I mean? Like, she's not the father. I can't say the father of.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, for sure. Like one of the first greats. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like going, you know, like, yeah, Janet Leigh, Tippi Hedren, Jamie Lee Curtis, like it all goes back to Fay Wray.
And she earns that title, by God.
Yeah. So getting ahead of myself a little bit, one of my favorite scenes in King Kong is when they're on the ship. They haven't even made it to Skull Island yet. And Denham is doing some camera tests with Fay Wray's character, Ann Darrow. And he's, you know, directing her behind the camera. And he's saying, oh, you're happy, you're laughing. But then you look up, you see something, you scream. So, like, we see what's going to happen later in the film in kind of this, like, fake for the movies sort of way. And it's one of many moments in which King Kong, I think, sort of, like, you know, pats itself in the back a little bit and like winks at the audience and says like, yeah, this is just a movie, but like it's still like, you know, it still takes you somewhere else. It's still so immersive and you won't think that it's just a movie in the next like 20 minutes, you know?
Yeah, that's a good moment.
So yeah, Robert Armstrong is Carl Denham. He's also in The Most Dangerous Game. Bruce Cabot as Jack Driscoll. I did want to shout out some of the actors who play the native characters in King Kong, and I know we're going to talk about how rough it can be and how difficult it can be to watch those scenes. But there's actually a very accomplished cast who play the native characters in this film. Etta McDaniel, for example, is the sister of Hattie McDaniel, who was the first Black actress who won an Oscar for Gone with the Wind 6 years later. Everett Brown, who plays Big Sam in Gone with the Wind, stars as the native in the gorilla costume. And just that, you know, description probably is a big hint as how offensive this movie is at times. Maybe, I think most interestingly, Noble Johnson plays the native chief in King Kong. He starred in a lot of other Hollywood movies like The Mummy and The Most Dangerous Game. But in 1916, he also founded his own production company, the Lincoln Motion Picture Company, in Nebraska with his brother George Perry Johnson. The reason why this was kind of important is because the Lincoln Motion Picture Company was a black film company that made race films in the silent era. So these were movies that had predominantly black casts. They were meant mostly for black audiences and dealt with racial issues that mainstream films were not really talking about at all. It's kind of overlooked a little bit and like wasn't as popular as mainstream films, but it was a big part of film history in the United States. Oscar Micheaux is one of the first black directors in the US, and he made a lot of race films at that time. So Noble Johnson ran the Lincoln Motion Picture Company until I think 1923, and then he would kind of leave that company to kind of do his own acting work. But until then, he would act in other films and use those salaries to fund projects that he really cared about, that dealt with issues that were very important to him and to black audiences at the time, including 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea from 1916. He starred in that film, which I have not seen, but I definitely want to. And I know this is a tangent for King Kong. It's not, you know, totally related to the film, but I did want to say that, like, you know, the extras or like the sort of minor actors that play the native characters in this film had an important role in American film history as well.
And you talking about Noble Johnson, he returns as this character in The Son of Kong, as well as Victor Wong, who plays Charlie the Cook aboard the SS Venture. Very small part in King Kong, a bigger part in Son of Kong. Son of Kong has its detractors. I like it a lot, by and large, because Charlie the Cook becomes part of like the main crew. Armstrong returns as Denim. The actor who plays Englehorn returns, Captain Englehorn. And then Charlie the Cook. They're like a trio all of a sudden. And it's Victor Wong is really great in both these movies.
That's awesome. I still have not seen Son of Kong. I decided to watch the 1976 version of King Kong instead. That might have been a mistake, but yeah, definitely excited to watch Son of Kong at some point.
It's silly. That's all I'll say.
Silly's great. We're all about that here. All right. So what was the atmosphere into which King Kong was released? There was so much going on in society at the time. Like you said before, it was the height of the Great Depression in 1933. There was also a fascination at the time with jungle and ape films. You know, they capitalized on audiences' desire for exotic settings and dangerous characters and animals, to put that in air quotes. And there was definitely an element of racial exploitation in many of these movies, you know, kind of capitalizing on predominantly white audiences' fear of and fascination with very exotic communities and people that they, you know, seem to be living a world away from them. We talked about some of them before. Chang, which Cooper and Schoedsack co-directed in 1927, was one example. The movie Rango from 1931, which was only directed by Schoedsack, is another example, and that follows characters in Sumatra who become friends with the titular orangutan. So these movies, you know, featured real animals, a lot of monkeys, a lot of primates and apes and things like that in supposedly authentic jungle settings. And I just want to bring up what this theorist Fatima Tobing-Rony calls teratology, or the study of abnormalities. She basically says that movies like this, like Chang and Rango and King Kong, are kind of, you know, heightening and exoticizing and exploiting what white audiences perceive to be a fascinating monstrosity among non-white communities. Kind of wrapping this up real quick, this conversation, which again, we could talk about this for the next hour, but this particular fad, probably the worst example of it is this movie Ngagi from 1930, which is a hoax documentary. It was presented as a documentary, but it was definitely not. It was released by Congo Pictures, and it supposedly depicts black women mating with gorillas and having human slash primate babies. I did actually watch it back in grad school at Emory University. I was in a pre-code cinema class, and it is not good. It is as disturbing as it sounds. But It did really well. It made a ton of money. And it's very possible that RKO greenlit King Kong because of movies like Ngagi. This was a whole, category or a corpus of films that were coming out around this time.
That's the perfect example of shifting societal norms. Again, just because it was the norm maybe back in the early 20th century to think about race in that way, for some people, obviously enough to make box office hits out of movies, didn't make it right, but it was accepted in a way that is not accepted today. And I think that's just speaks to why King Kong is a dated movie in a lot of ways, with its human characters and depictions of the non-white characters.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's hard to watch the scenes with the native characters in King Kong. Placing it in this context does not make it really any better, but it does kind of just make you realize how complex of a history there was behind it, you know?
Yeah. So at the end of this episode, when we talk about does it stand the test of time or not, in a lot of ways, no.
Right.
Just not.
It's hard to get past it. It's hard to celebrate this movie like uninhibitedly with all that stuff in it, you know?
Yeah. As much as there is, that does stand the test of time.
Exactly. Yeah.
It is what it is, folks. We're talking about a 90-year-old movie at this point.
Yeah. And that's the importance of talking about film history, you know?
Yeah.
To shift focus to King Kong itself a little bit. So supposedly the film was conceived when Marion C. Cooper, I'm very sorry, I'm distracted by my pet right now. Marion C. Cooper had a dream in which a giant gorilla terrorizes New York City. The real influence, we already kind of talked about this a little bit. Cooper loved monkeys since the age of six. He talked about that book that he, from the 1860s, that he read as a kid and he loved. Supposedly while shooting The Four Feathers, Cooper also met a family of baboons that furthered his love of monkeys, which is kind of funny to imagine, I think, while he's making this like sort of weirdly colonialist movie. So, you know, in a way, like King Kong is sometimes described as Cooper's brainchild, even though it is also Choate-Sack's film and Willis O'Brien's film and the whole cast and crew's film. But in a way, King Kong is kind of like the culmination of Cooper's like boyhood dreams and fantasies. Like it all came together in King Kong. This is where the film Creation comes into play. Did you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, so Creation was a movie that O'Brien was working on before King Kong at RKO. It was going to be his showstopper with the stop motion. The story concerned a group of wealthy aristocrat type people who go on pleasure cruising, and there's a storm at sea. There's a waterspout tornado that they get into a submarine. It sucks them down into the ocean where a crevasse opens up. The submarine goes down and it comes up into this lost world of dinosaurs and ancient creatures. Action sequence. They escape. There's a volcano and credits roll. Very similar to what we saw in The Lost World from 1925. Very similar to things we would see in King Kong. This movie Creation was never completed because it was way too expensive. This is where Selznick brought Cooper into RKO to oversee projects that could be cut at the studio. Creation was one of those. Cooper did not like what he was seeing with Creation as a whole, but he loved the effects and realized through stop motion, through O'Brien, this is how he can get his giant gorilla movie made. So there's like 4 minutes of footage still left from Creation that they had test shot. But a lot of it still just exists in storyboards and a screenplay that's still around. That's Creation, a direct link to the King Kong story that would come out of it.
That's awesome. It's so cool when like, the seeds of King Kong and that like aborted project, but still kind of came to fruition in their own way. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So King Kong was shot at RKO Studios in the spring and summer of 1932. The gigantic gate set was recycled from Cecil B. DeMille's King of Kings from 1927. So they were definitely trying to, you know, cut back on costs however they could, reuse sets. Supposedly, Shaw and Sack focused on the scenes with human actors, while Cooper worked very closely with O'Brien to focus on the special effects scenes. I feel like we need to talk about the legendary scene, which supposedly was filmed and was going to be part of King Kong, and then was cut by RKO before they released the movie.
Well, yes, maybe. So I think this ties into the re-release in 1938, which is when they cut a lot of the more violent images out of the movie, because that was post the Hays Code.
Right.
So if you don't mind me kind of wrapping all this in together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the film was a huge success upon its release. We can say these numbers, but it doesn't really do it justice. You know, its initial run, it sold out. I think it opened at Radio City Music Hall and played from Thursday to Sunday, 10 shows a day, and it sold out every single one of them. So it made its money back on the first weekend in one theater.
Especially for how much it cost. Like, this was a very expensive production, you know?
Incredibly expensive. So yeah, it's re-released then 5 years later in 1938. And this is where, as film lovers and historians know, a lot happened in 5 years. Before 1933, what's known as the pre-code Hollywood, the Hays Code, which was a committee it was a censorship board that screened movies for sex, violence, you know, all sorts of quote unquote immoral things. But King Kong was initially released before the Hays Code. So you got scenes such as men being eaten by the Brontosaurus, King Kong undressing and sniffing his fingers, which admittedly is like, why would you put that in there? But hey, he's an animal. Natives being killed. Like, there's a lot of violence in this movie that was cut from the re-release in 1938. And one of those, so the scene you speak about, the spider pit sequence, I think it's uncertain if it was if it was cut before 1933 or if it was cut as part of that 1938 re-release. Either way, it's lost footage. Some stills exist. And what it was is after the sequence where Kong throws these people off of the log across the canyon, they fall down into the pit below, where in the screenplay it is described as insects and other monsters appear from the walls and eat them,
which sounds terrifying.
And if you've seen Peter Jackson's remake, he does that scene justice. I feel like it's one of the most disturbing moments of Jackson's cover of this movie. So anyways, the lost spider pit sequence is infamous. It's one of the, you know, when people talk about lost movies, there's a few that really stand out. Like, if someone can get their hands on a copy of that, it would make news. Like, it's a big deal.
Definitely, yeah. And I just want to say that the there is some ambiguity or lack of clarity around it. The version that I read is that that scene was included in a sneak preview screening in 1933. And the audience, like, a lot of people walked out. Some other people said that they, like, lost interest in the movie after that because it was, like, so horrifying. That's all that they could think of. So, like, RKO cut it before they released it into theaters. The version that I read, there's a historian, Ray Morton, who wrote about this in a book, which is, that's the part that I've read. But there's so much, like, lore and, like, legend around this. I don't know if anybody knows exactly what happened.
And just speaking of so much lore, I'm surprised at how much I didn't know about the history of this film. So after that 1938 re-release, when so much was cut out of the movie, that what was cut out was lost until the 60s. So from 1938 until like the early to mid 60s, what people saw was not what we're watching now. And then it was discovered in America on some grainy 16 millimeter copies. But what we watched, like at the Heights or what you buy on DVD, comes from original film that was released in Britain. And Great Britain's censorship board did not cut any of what was cut in America. So that's the print that everything we watch today is based on.
And that's the importance of film archiving and restoration, you know, like, because I think they pulled together like this, like as finished as possible version from like various film prints throughout the world and like had to like clean up like very heavy scratches and stuff like that. So yeah, like a long quest to like make this the movie that it is today, you know, and that it originally was.
Yeah. And it's such a famous movie. If you're like me, you're surprised that there was so much distorted. It's a classic that was heavily messed with.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's sad, like just how many movies have been like kind of butchered in some way or like lost or whatever, but makes you appreciate what we do have even more. That's the way I like to look at it anyway, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, I think now is a good time for a sponsor break. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Bank Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. So yeah, thanks to Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, and thanks to anybody who reached out to us in Minya's mailbox. Do we have anything to mention on today's show?
Oh yeah, just a few things. We're going to do it a little different here. So on Instagram, I asked folks, you know, what are your thoughts on the original King Kong? And we got a couple of people writing in. Giovanni P027 says he is one of the great ones. Kensukete says, Big Ape, go boom. IHOP _better_ says, the feel of how old the film is, it's a 10 out of 10.
Nice. I would agree with that.
Yeah, everybody, just write in on Instagram or send us an email. We'll get your comments featured on the show. I also thought it'd be neat to share a couple of comments from historical figures, Ray Harryhausen and E.G. Tsuburaya, who explicitly quote this film as reasons they got into visual effects. So Tsuburaya says, my movie company came up with a very interesting script that combines King Kong and Godzilla. So I couldn't help working on this production instead of my new fantasy films. This script is very special to me. It struck a deep emotional chord because it was seeing King Kong back in 1933 that sparked my interest in the world of special visual effects. That's Tsuburaya. I'll read Harryhausen's quote here. Just briefly, he says, I went to see it again and again. I was a King Kong addict. I love the way the film took you from the mundane world into the surreal.
He's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a weird kind of mix of like realism and fantasy in King Kong. And like realism is probably kind of a weird word to bring up. But I think in like, I don't know, the scenes in New York at the beginning and the end, we definitely see that. I think in some of the scenes on the ship too, there's like a certain sort of like natural quality. Yeah, I think he has a point.
So there you go. Thanks, Tsuburaya and Harryhausen, for writing into Minya's mailbox. We love the work you do. Keep it up.
I'm honored that they even know about us. It's a, yeah, reaching out from beyond the grave. That's pretty awesome. All right. So we've talked about the themes of King Kong quite a bit, but I think we can dive in even further. You know, Marion C. Cooper insisted that like there were no hidden meanings to this movie, and they're probably right. Like, it's probably just meant to be like escapist adventure fare. But as we've already talked about, there are so many different themes and contexts that can be brought into it. We've already talked a little bit about this kind of, you know, racist atmosphere of the 19th and early 20th centuries, in which, you know, people of African descent were deemed by some racist people, including racist scientists, as, you know, kind of ape-like in their demeanor and sort of innately inferior because of a certain race's physical and intellectual attributes.
Right.
Again, we know today, or we should know today, that this is complete bullshit. And, you know, it's kind of like, it's still horrifying and shocking to think about this. But at the time, it was kind of seen as like a scientific discipline. And King Kong does reflect that in some uncomfortable ways.
Yeah, I mean, this was the era of eugenics, and the certainly the state of Germany, Nazi Germany, was founded upon such principles.
And Hitler loved this movie.
He was a fan. Yep. Unlike Dr. Mabuse, he liked a King Kong.
Yeah, probably don't need to say any more about that. We'll just leave it there. You know, so like a lot of theorists and commentators have talked about King Kong since it came out as like a cautionary tale against interracial love. If the love story is between King Kong and Ann Darrow, and it ends so tragically, especially for King Kong, who is punished for the love and the lust that he feels for Ann Darrow, you know, a lot of critics have kind of read that subtext into it as well. And I think it's there. That reading is definitely there, you know?
And in all the gorilla movies to come.
Yeah.
Not as good as, you know, visually, you know, effects wise as King Kong. But yeah, it is a not so subtle racial stereotype that unfortunately makes its mark on popular cinema in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think at the same time, King Kong can be read as a tragic figure. I think, you know, he typically is seen as a tragic figure, but in the specific sense that, you know, this American crew goes to another country, chains up King Kong, brings him back to the United States against his will, and exploits him for his labor to make money. I mean, you know, Cooper and Schoedsack did not intend this to be an allegory for slavery, but I think like the empathy and the compassion that we feel for King Kong, you know, maybe partially stems from that a little bit, you know?
Yeah. And I don't think they intended this movie to be, first of all, I don't think they intended to be anything more than a pulp adventure,
mm-hmm.
but watching it in 2023, in terms of the environmental messaging, I mean, for many reasons, I do not sympathize with the crew of the venture. Not only are they exploiting the living animal creature of the island, but you can read it as them exploiting the natural ecosystem and environment of the island. Going in, guns a-blazing. I mean, they're just shooting. They shoot that poor stegosaurus. I mean, it was charging at them. But, like, there's no respect for the living creatures of the island. It's just go in, take what you can, and just forget about it.
Yeah, they're Americans at their worst, you know. It's like money and power hungry, and like everybody else be damned, basically.
Yeah
Again, you know, probably not intentional. I mean, Cooper and Schoedsack both were considered themselves patriots and fought for the United States military and all that, so yeah. But yeah, I mean, like this reading kind of leads into another one of the film's big themes, which is the clash between civilization and a kind of pure natural world. And which one is actually more civilized and more, you know, good and honorable than the other? I mean, there's a throwaway line towards the end that's actually really funny when all these like well-dressed socialites in New York are going to the theater to see King Kong. And there's a woman who's sitting in her seat, and this guy sort of just like rudely brushes past her and like knocks her out of the way. And she says something about like, oh, we already have enough gorillas in New York, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a funny line, but I think also that is one of the themes of the film. Like, you know, in this age of civilization, is it even really possible to sort of like connect with this pure untouched world anymore?
Yeah. And then the fact that a modern war machine, the airplane, is used to bring Kong, the emblem of this pure nature, to his death. It's like an interesting reversal. You know, Kong comes as the ostensible destroyer of worlds, but in the end, it's the modern world that destroys him. And I think actually, if you dwell on that last scene when he's getting all bloodied with riddled with bullets, it can leave you uncomfortable because it's there's an ambiguity there of like, oh wait, who is the monster in this movie?
Right.
There's no clear answer. And yeah, it surprisingly sits with you after you watch the movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the last line, oh no, it wasn't the airplanes, it was beauty killed the beast, is classic and amazing and very powerful. But I don't know if it's actually totally accurate because
this is the point.
Yeah, it's Denim and his crew that killed the beast. Very, and like this kind of whole war machine, as you put it, you know, they killed the beast, and it's all the blame should be placed on them, you know?
Yeah, it's a glorified, I mean, Denim and Denim is the leader of this, but it's a glorified safari going into Skull Island. It's a trophy hunt.
Yeah.
They shoot Kong at the end, and you see a crazy version of this movie where they taxidermy his head and put it on the wall of a lodge or something.
That would be a powerful ending. Wow. Truly subversive.
It's just an adventure film.
Well, yeah. I'm surprised one of the remakes didn't do something like that, though.
I will say, so Son of Kong picks up immediately after the events, and Denim is in hot water because, yeah, he caused the death of a lot of people and a lot of property damage, and he's on the hook for all of that. So he makes a quick getaway. He basically, yeah, flees the country and goes back to Skull Island.
Wow. I think we have to bring Son of Kong to the show sometime soon because it sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, again, like whether or not these themes are intentional, they're all there and they make the movie still extremely rich and fascinating 90 years later. So, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, in talking about the form and aesthetic of the film, we should talk a little bit more about the special effects, which are some of the best ever. I mean, revolutionary, you know? Yeah, we don't, you know, we have a lot of information here, but we can kind of summarize this a little bit, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Willis O'Brien and the model animator Marcel Delgado spent a long time on the King Kong model. At first, they tried to do kind of a combination of like a human and an ape look, which Marion C. Cooper hated. He was like, no, I want it to be a gorilla, like a ferocious gorilla from the jungles of Africa or whatever, you know? So that ultimately is what King Kong resembled more. There aren't too many human features in the final version of him. And the special effects in general are really fascinating, a very effective combination of, you know, stop motion animation, rear projection, miniatures, matte paintings, very difficult and time consuming. The Kong versus T-Rex fight, which is one of the more kind of legendary scenes in the movie, took 7 weeks to make in itself.
Yeah. For not even maybe 5 minutes of screen time. Yeah, the calculation is roughly for stop motion as an art form, 1 minute of screen time could take 150 hours to film.
Man, that's just the level of care and like meticulousness involved in that. It's amazing.
But it's such a Herculean effort to do something like that. I think there's no surprise when you realize that after King Kong and Son of Kong the same year, this is not a popular way to bring giant monsters to the screen because it's incredibly labor intensive and expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's worth it. I think even the sense that we can like see King Kong's fur kind of like shift in it, like kind of every shot or whatever, you know, because like the animators are obviously touching him and like it's like a tactile quality that just adds to the wonder of it, you know.
I think it's beautiful. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and in other O'Brien films and Harryhausen films, I mean, that's the magic of cinema. That transports me to a different place in my brain than seeing even the best computer animated movies.
Right.
There's something about stop motion that does transport me to another place.
Absolutely. I feel totally the same way. And that's why the 2005 remake by Peter Jackson has its moments, but like even the special effects, which were like cutting edge CGI, just cannot compare. It's not the same thing at all. And the 1976 special effects were like, man, in like a wasteland in between like great stop motion and good CGI. So they're terrible. Like, yeah, it's don't even get me started on the 1976 version.
I feel like even crude stop motion ages better than crude CGI.
I do agree with that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because there are some dinosaurs in Peter Jackson's film that do not hold up.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree. But yeah, I mean, like in the original, it's still totally wondrous. It's amazing that they were able to achieve this. And just the level of like innovation involved, like, you know, having two strips of film and the camera at the same time, having like tiny little rear projection screens and the miniature sets that were made of condoms. All this stuff is just like, just the level of creativity involved. It creates
creativity because they were inventing these techniques for this movie. This had never been done before on this scale.
What must it have been like to be one of those audience members in 1933 selling out Radio City Music Hall or whatever, you know? Like, it's totally new vision.
Like, what am I watching? It's the first, not just first giant monster movie, but the first movie completely where its star is completely animated, not of this world, and somehow it looks lifelike.
Yeah.
Complete game changer with visual effects.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the best fantasy visions that's ever been created on film. Do you think we should get into the good, the bad, and the campy section?
I think so. I think it's a good transition.
Okay, cool. We've talked about, you know, talked about a lot, obviously. We'll bring up some other stuff in the good, the bad, and the campy here. Yeah, so obviously so much that's good about this film. So many classic scenes. Empire State Building climax and like these amazing shots where like it's from an airplane's point of view and it's rushing towards King Kong. Still very, very exhilarating and very stylish. And the last thing that I'll put in my good category, even though there's so much that's good about this film, is Fay Wray. Like, I love watching her in this film. Her character is not especially deep, but she's just so charismatic. And I, you know, I just think that, like, I don't know. I love horror movies and I love scream queens and I love like women who actresses who seem strong and resilient, even if their characters are maybe kind of like vulnerable and almost sort of inept at times, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that describes Fay Wray in this movie.
Yeah. Do you know it's Fay Wray who picked out the blonde wig? It was her idea to be blonde.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah. She said that. Well, the anecdote is, I think it was Cooper went up to Ray and said, I want you to be in this movie and the you're going to want to do it because the leading man is, you know, very tall, very dark, very handsome. And she was like, oh, is it Cary Grant?
I love that story.
Yeah. But because King Kong was, you know, tall, dark and handsome, she decided a blonde wig would look better as a contrast to his dark fur. I was like, yeah, that's smart.
Yeah, I think she's right.
Yeah. What do I love about this movie? Yeah. I love the really specificity of the entire movie. It didn't take the easy way out and just like give us a rampaging monster. In the New York sequence, when Kong crushes the train, right in the lower bottom left-hand corner of the screen, you see people falling out of the windows. Mm-hmm. And they're stop motion too. And you're just like, oh, wow, I would never notice that. And there's moments where I can see real sadness in Kong's eyes that O'Brien was clearly attuned enough to add in there. And there's a really interesting flash of like theme in the movie right at the end. When Fay Wray first gets back, she's saved and she's on the other side of the wall. Carl Denham says, let's use her as bait.
Mm-hmm.
They've just gone through this whole thing. And now he's got a crazed look in his eyes. And he's suddenly like unmoored from reality. And I was like, oh, my God, what? The movie didn't take that direction. But what if it took that direction where Denham becomes kind of a unhinged character?
Yeah, he's on the verge, I think, throughout the entire film, but he never becomes like an absolute villain, you know?
Yeah.
Or at least he still has kind of like the blustery charm about him. But yeah, he's a megalomaniac for sure.
Yeah. He's not crazy. No, is he crazy? No, he's just enthusiastic.
That's a great line, yeah. Well done. Perfect, perfectly used, yeah.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And what you said about the sadness in Kong's eyes, like the 76 and the 2005 remakes, like play into that a lot more. Like it is an actual love story between Anne and King Kong. But I think it's almost more interesting here because it's like the movie doesn't want to depict that, but it does anyway, you know? Like there is like a sincerity that develops between them, and it's very, very touching.
One more thing I just want to add, just briefly. I found the action sequences really thrilling. It's not just the T-Rex and Kong fight, but when Anne is in the tree at eye level with Kong and the T-Rex, you're seeing the fight from her eyes, and her proximity to the danger is very effective. And then there's that great shot when the tree falls over, it gets knocked over, and she atop the tree is rushing towards the camera.
Yeah.
Even me watching this movie in 2023, I knew it's not coming through the screen, but it felt like that tree was falling on me. And it was very disorientating, and I loved it.
Yeah, totally. Like, I feel like a lot of the cinematography doesn't really call attention to itself, just in the sense that there aren't, like, long tracking shots and, like, zooms and stuff like that. But in, like, small ways like that, like, you really do feel like you're in this world. It's very, very effective.
Yeah.
But there is some bad in the film as well, as we've already talked about. Do you want to start off this one, or should I do so?
Yeah, I'll just say briefly, I mean, everything we have already critiqued, I'm not going to reiterate. I will say the first third of this movie, before they get to Skull Island, is very indicative of its time period when films were more static in their presentation, with the maybe the cinematography, but also the acting and the just a lot of standing around and talking.
Mm-hmm.
Great script, like good talking and standing around, but it can be a little slow by today's standards. And it's something that often creeps up into older monster movies. And it's here as well.
I would agree with that. I think a lot of like the first part of the movie is focused on Driscoll and Anne and their like burgeoning relationship. But Driscoll is not a very likable character. And like, I don't really buy their romance. So it's hard to invest in that too much, you know?
Yeah.
I think even though we did talk about a lot of the subtexts and things like that, there's not like a lot of intentional thematic depth to this movie. And I do think that's a weakness. Like, you know, Godzilla, I think, will always be my favorite monster movie because it has so much political and social intentional themes about like nuclear devastation personified. And King Kong is meant to be escapist adventure fare. And I love movies like that, but I do, you know, I think ideally you combine that with a little bit of thematic richness. And I think there's not a lot of that intentionally in this movie, which maybe is unfair, but I still think it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And just the last thing I'll say about the racist stereotypes, which are, you know, again, hard to watch. I just don't understand why the remakes don't complicate that at all. Like the 76 and the 2005 version both have similarly offensive stereotypical depictions of like the natives on the island. And it's like, oh, in 33, I kind of get it. Like it sucks and it's not a good thing, but like it's a product of its time. Peter Jackson and Jeff Gearman, whatever the director's name is, who made the 76 version. Like, what are you doing? Like, try to complicate this a little bit, you know? So it's bad in this original version, but I think it's even worse in the remix that they don't even try to, like, address that at all, you know?
Yeah, and you haven't seen Kong Skull Island, but that movie gets it right.
Okay.
In terms of the four depictions of natives of Skull Island. They're a peaceful tribe. They are South East Asian peoples. It's done with a lot of care.
That's good to hear. I've never particularly wanted to see that movie all that much, but now I feel like I have to. That sounds great. What do you have for the campy category?
Oh my gosh, where to begin? No, seriously, I have to think about this because we were watching it in a theater, so I wasn't taking notes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that moment where, you know, Engelhorn says he's not crazy. He's just enthusiastic. That was very funny. Kong does things that are very funny, you know, very campy, I would say. Just being an ape, exploring his world, and it comes off charming. The woman, like you said, the rich women in the Broadway theater. New York's got enough gorillas.
And the other woman who's like, I thought we were seeing a picture.
Yeah.
I love them. Yeah.
It's a great comment, almost a meta comment on filmmaking itself.
Yeah. Right. And how people are so like maybe easily disappointed, you know, like there's this eighth wonder of the world before you and you're like complaining about all these things.
Yeah.
The close-ups of Kong's face were done using like a mechanical model of King Kong, and they like the stop motion stuff is great, but the mechanical stuff maybe not so great. Mm-hmm. And I think like all the close-ups of like a human being in Kong's mouth, but then it like cuts to like a wider shot and then like Kong just like puts the human down. It like never actually eats the human that's in its mouth. Like it's just like a toothpick or something.
Yeah.
I find that really funny. And you know, that's the campy moment for me.
There's a lot of humor in the movie, a lot of unintentional humor again, just cause it's dated, especially with Jack and Anne's relationship, but there's a lot of intentional humor as well that comes through.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's time to give King Kong a rating. Are you ready?
That's about time.
Yeah, indeed. We could talk a lot more about this movie, but time to wrap it up. As usual on Camp Kaiju, our ratings are: number one, it's a timeless classic and definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. Number four, it's not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time. Should I go first and then you can have the last word? Or
sure.
Okay. So for me, this movie definitely stands the test of time, but for me, it's not quite a timeless classic. Like it is hard to get past like the very troublesome subtext of the atmosphere in which this movie came out, some of its more offensive and racist depictions. And I do wish that there was a little bit more intentional, like thematic weight to the film. But I mean, it is a classic. It stands the test of time. There are so many amazing scenes. It's just like not one of my like, you know, beloved monster movie favorites, but yeah, it's classic.
I feel the same way. I mean, I'll be honest, right? There are dated moments, there are antiquated moments, you know, just talking about the story, it doesn't offer much.
Mm-hmm.
But where this movie stands the test of time and where it is a classic is in the creature sequences. Like, God, I could just watch that last hour all the time.
Yeah.
It's just so good on top of the historical context. But the effects, I think, hold up. I'm mesmerized by them. I'm captivated by them. I'm just like a little kid again in this world.
Yeah.
I loved watching it truly on the big screen. I get chills thinking about it. It was so much fun.
Absolutely. It was an amazing experience. Thanks again to The Heights for showing this film. It's, yeah, really wonderful to see it on the big screen. You know, it kind of reminded me a little bit of A Trip to the Moon, which we just talked mm-hmm. about on the podcast recently, which is, A Trip to the Moon is over 100 years old now. But like still like the like marvelous tricks that it's able to do and like the illusions that it convinces you are really happening. I mean, sometimes I think special effects from like 100 years ago are better than what we have now. So
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yep. I totally agree.
O'Brien, bow down to the king.
Yes. The father of stop motion animation.
Yeah. Oh, man.
All right. Well, thank you all for hanging out. If you liked what you hear, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit campkaijumoviereviews.com or Instagram for more monster movie content. We cannot thank you enough. Camp Kaiju was recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with theme music by Terrence Jackson and Minya's Mailbox by Ben Cook Feltz. Finally, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. And we'll see you next time on Camp Kaiju.
For some Godzilla, Mothra, King Ghidorah, and Baragon, let us not forget.
I can't believe they left him out. He's maybe my favorite part of the movie.
Agreed. And that's a wrap.
Say, what is it anyhow?
I hear it's a kind of a gorilla.
Gee, ain't we got enough of them in New York?